Hello and welcome to the Happy Dog Podcast. Today we're going to continue our mini series on separation anxiety. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about some mistakes that are commonly made when people start to treat their dog who is struggling to be home alone. So get comfy, get a cuppa and enjoy. A lot of the mistakes that people make are obviously completely unintentional. They have either picked them up from searching online, from Googling, from previous dogs that they've had or worked with, or they are just things that they're trying along the way. There's nothing necessarily wrong with a lot of them. It's just that they're not that effective and they're not that useful, and they're probably just going to slow your training down overall. So I thought I'd go through them and we can chat about why they're not really the best way, or maybe they're just like a little cheat that you can use to help along the way. For example, a lot of people who are working with dogs with separation anxiety often will give the dog something to eat, like a stuffed Kong or a long lasting chew or something like that, while they're gone. And the dog is quite happy to eat that item. And it kind of masks the problem because the dog's occupied, they're busy, but they're not really learning in that situation. So let's break it down. Firstly, if you've got a dog that's really anxious, there's a really high potential that they're not going to eat. If you're in a particularly stressful situation or a stressful environment, eating is generally the last thing on your mind. If you're in a situation and your body's got to the point of the fight or flight response, so a real severe stress response, then what will generally happen is that your brain will stop your digestive tract. It won't want it to do any work because that functionality needs to go to the limbs to be able to run away or defend ourselves from whatever the threat is. So quite often, and I hope this isn't too graphic for a podcast, quite often if you're in a particularly stressful situation, very nervous, big job interview, stressful exam, you'll need the toilet before you go. And that's part of that response. The cortisol levels in your system are rising and your body goes, oh, well, we don't want to be doing any digestion right now, so let's expel everything from the body. And it'll also kind of inhibit you from taking anything in. So if you're going into a big job interview or into a big exam, and I came along and was like, do you want some chocolate cake? You might be like, well, right now, no, I really don't. And that is part of that response. It's that response that says anything that's not needed at that time, we need to get rid of. And so some dogs, when they're really stressed, when they're on their own, they're not even going to want to eat. They're not going to want to take anything on board. And so that is one major thing. One major part of it is that a lot of people, or a lot of dogs who are really stressed, they're not going to eat. So if you've got a dog like that, food is irrelevant because you're not going to get anywhere with it. But it also masks the problem. If you have got a dog who is able to eat when they are home alone, even though they are stressed and they're struggling with separation anxiety, what happens when that food runs out? So let's say you can give your dog a Kong, a really nice frozen Kong, stuffed full of really good stuff, going to keep your dog super, super entertained for a really prolonged period of time. Let's say 45 minutes. I've got power chewers in my house. I'm sure some dogs can cope for longer, but let's just go for 45 minutes. So you take your dog up, you give them the Kong, they start munching on it, you jump in the car and you go to the supermarket. But what you've forgotten is that the supermarket's shut. It's Easter weekend, for example, and the supermarket's shut on Sunday. So every single person in the town has gone to the supermarket and it's heaving. So your normal half hour shop today takes 45 minutes and then 10 minute drive home. What's your dog going to have done? What's going to have happened in that period of time where they finished eating the Kong? And then you get home. Are they going to freak out? Are they going to panic? Are they going to start trying to escape? Are they going to search for you? Are they barking, howling, crying? What's going on? And then how do we mitigate that in the future? How do we make that so, okay, the Kong's going to run out. I do need to be out for an hour and a half because I've got an appointment. So then what are you going to do? Line up Kongs, have several Kongs, build a wall of Kongs for your dogs just to work through. Are you going to feed them for 3-4 hours every time you need to go out? So as much as, yes, we can use it as a cheat. I often get people, if they say, oh, my dog can eat a Kong for half an hour. I'm like, that's brilliant. We can sometimes use that with dogs. If you just need to pop out and get some milk, if you just need to pop to the shops, if you just need to go and get a couple of bits here or there, and you're really confident that that chew or that Kong or whatever it is that they're being left with is going to last longer. So when you come back in, they're still eating. Then yes, we can have it as like a little cheat, but it's not part of our treatment plan. It's not part of fixing separation anxiety. The other problem that we have with it is it sometimes, especially something as obvious as a Kong, or a, more so with the Kong, but chews can be it as well, is that they become what we call poison cues, and they tell the dog when the Kong appears that they're going to be left. And it can sometimes backfire, and then the Kong becomes part of the pre-departure cues, and it becomes a real problem. And then the dog won't eat because they, from a Kong at any time, even if you're there with them, because they just like, oh God, at some point you're going to leave me because that's the only time I get a Kong. So sometimes like then we can't use Kongs, and we all know like a dog trainer does love a Kong for their dogs. So we do need to make sure that they are always able to be relaxed, but we don't want to be using food to facilitate that. But like I say, sometimes with some dogs, we can just get away with using a long lasting food thing, whatever it might be, to just be able to do those little tasks that I find a lot of people are, that they struggle with the most. So a lot of the time it isn't the big things. People can get cover for their dogs for a couple of hours, during the day or overnight or something, because that is normal. It's normal to say to someone, oh, I'm going to be out all day on Tuesday. Can you look after my dog for a few hours? Yes, I can. But if you run out of milk or bread and you just need to pop to the co-op for like 2 minutes, it's really hard to get cover for that time. So that's when we can sometimes use it, but it's not a treatment plan for our dogs. Okay, so another mistake that I see quite frequently is that we are building up departure in set time blocks. So what I mean by this is that people start with 30 seconds and then they try and increase all of their departure times by that fixed time duration. And there's a couple of things with this, is that the difference between 15 seconds and 30 seconds is huge. 30 seconds of silence, I'm not going to do it because no one wants to listen to 30 seconds of silence, but 30 seconds of silence is a really long time, much longer than 15 seconds. And 15 seconds on its own is a significant amount of time if you've got a dog that really cannot cope with being left home alone. So they are relatively big jumps at the beginning of the training plan, going up by a set amount, 15 seconds all of the time, or 30 seconds, or whatever the set duration is. When you're working at very short time periods, they're really big jumps. And a lot of the time, dogs can't cope with a 15-second standard increase. However, if they can, although I don't think I've met a dog that can yet, but if they can, the difference between 5 minutes 15 and 5 minutes 30 is hardly any increase at all. You wouldn't necessarily notice if I went silent for 5:15 or for 5:30. You wouldn't necessarily notice the difference between them. And even more so at like 30 minutes, 30 minutes 15 and 30 minutes 30, there's hardly any difference. So what we have to look at is increasing the duration that the dog is left for at a more relative amount to the time that they're being left for. So you want, if your dog is only being left for very short durations, 5-10 seconds, then the increase needs to be relative to that, a couple of seconds. if they're being left for much longer periods of time, 20, 30 minutes, then the jumps in those increases also have to be relative, minutes rather than seconds. So by starting out on these kind of fixed time increases, when you're really looking at being able to increase by 1 or 2 seconds, you're really setting the dog up to fail right from the beginning. And then if you just stick at that time, it's not necessarily going to aid you in the long run, because it's going to take you a really long time to get from 20 minutes to 30 minutes. Whereas actually those jumps could probably be a lot bigger and a lot more effective. So we want to be working out our increases in duration relative to how long the one was before. We discussed in great detail in the last podcast about why we don't want to let our dogs cry it out when they are young or when they're old. It is not an effective strategy, and it's definitely not going to teach them that they can cope by themselves. So if you haven't listened to the previous podcast, please go back and listen to it, because I go into a lot of detail about how it affects the brain and how it affects the dog's processing abilities later in life. Another mistake that people make is when they've got a puppy who is struggling with separation anxiety, is that they think that the puppy is just going to naturally grow out of the behaviour. And unfortunately, in most cases, they don't grow out of it. They learn that the behaviours, which we discussed in episode one of this series, either are self-soothing, escape behaviours, or behaviours designed to bring people back together. So all of those things mean that those behaviours are going to continually be used when they're on their own. So if you've got a dog who is howling, for example, when they're left on their own, howling is a behaviour that dogs will exhibit to bring a group back together, which is great because you will always come back. So far, every time I've left my house, I've come back. My dogs are always reunited with me. And so every time I leave, they're going to display that behavior because I always come back. If they're destroying furniture, if they're destroying things, then that's going to be a self-soothing behavior. It's going to make them feel a little bit better. They're going to get out of their system some of the frustration and anxiety that they feel by destroying things and ripping things up. So it's, if we let them, if we try to let them grow out of it, potentially we're going to allow a dog to feel anxious and stressed for prolonged periods of time. But also what we're doing is we're allowing them to practice behaviours that are effective to them. So one thing we know about learning and behaviour is that any animal will repeat behaviours that are successful for them. So if they're repeating the behaviour, it's strengthening it. And by strengthening it, it's going to make it harder to get rid of in the long run, which is why I offer a puppy programme, because I really want to get in early. As soon as we start to see these signs of stress and anxiety in our dogs when we're leaving them, because we're not giving them time to practice, and practice makes permanent. So the more we practice, or the more they practice, the more permanent that behavior is going to get, and the more challenging, although not impossible by any stretch, but the more challenging it is to resolve later in life. So the earlier we can get in, the less time that they've had to practice, the better. A lot of people will get a second dog to help their first, which for some dogs will give them the companionship that they feel that they need when they're on their own. And sometimes second dogs often can't cope if the first dog isn't there, because they've never really been on their own. So yes, it can work. It can also backfire quite spectacularly. And then you have two dogs who've got separation anxiety and who can't cope if the other one's not there. So you've added an additional layer into your separation anxiety training that we need to work through. We also have to be really careful that we're not getting the second dog just to fix the first, because dogs are expensive and they're a huge commitment. So are we getting a second dog because we want one and it might help the first dog who's struggling? Or is it more about just trying to fix the first dog? Because if it's just trying to fix the first dog, it's cheaper, more cost effective, more time effective to just treat your separation anxiety rather than getting a second dog, which is time consuming on its own, is expensive, and is expensive for a much, much longer period of time. We also might get a new puppy learning behaviors from their old dog who's struggling. So you're, like I say, potentially you're going to have two dogs who have got separation anxiety. So it might work, yes, it might backfire, but please don't get a second dog just to help the first one. Get a second dog because you want one, but let's really work on making sure that all of our dogs are fully happy and confident and settled being home on their own. And one of the biggest mistakes, and I try and get people to work on all of the time, is not recording the dog when you are out. So I still record my dogs on a regular basis when I go out, because you just don't know what's happening when you're not there. So whether you've got a dog with separation anxiety, you're not sure if your dog's got separation anxiety, you're fairly confident your dog doesn't have separation anxiety, or you're training your dog with separation anxiety, we should all be recording our dogs on a regular basis when we are not there. You can either use a dog cam and get them to, you know, watch in real time, or set up your phone, your tablet, whatever it might be that you've got available. And when you get back, you watch the recording and see what's happened. I would highly recommend, if you've got a dog who does struggle with separation anxiety, that you do have a live cam that you can watch in real time, because you don't want to be assuming that they're okay when they're not coping. But not knowing isn't going to help in any way, shape or form. We need to be proactive, not bury our heads in the sand and hope that our dogs are okay. We need to make sure that they are happy and content and they haven't got these periods of anxiety when we can actually do something about it. It's like I said before, it's only going to make things worse if we're allowing our dogs to practice these behaviors every single time we go out. Instead, we want to be setting them up for success. We want to be building a program that allows the increments of time that they're left to be short enough to be successful, but long enough to be challenging for the dog. We want to make sure that they're not experiencing periods of anxiety at any time, because it has a huge impact on their overall health and well-being. And we need to make sure that when we are setting our dogs up, that we're doing it that's appropriate for them. So not using a crate, allowing them to have lots of space, allowing them to have places to rest and relax and chill, teaching them that being left home alone is absolutely fine and they can completely cope by themselves. And this is the way that we're going to get a really strong and solid plan in place. When I help people with separation anxiety, we look at so many different things. We look at the relationship with the dog. We look at everyone's relationship with the dog, if they have a primary caregiver. We look at the way the home's set up. We look at what they've done previously, because most people have at some point tried things to help separation anxiety. We really help build a community around you and your dog. So you've got people to help you look after the dog day to day if you need to go out. And by doing all of those things, we're always looking at ways that we can get the dog to succeed with their training plan. For my clients, they all have like a daily training plan that I write for them. And it's all uploaded and we can share it and we can see it and I can see what's going on. Don't worry, you do get a couple of days off a week and it's there's no fines if you get behind. But, you know, you've got everything written down. So from my point of view, I try and reduce everyone else's ability to make errors by setting it up in such a way that it's almost fail proof. And we've had brilliant results from doing that. So hope that that's helped. I'm sure maybe some of you were like, oh, I'm a bit guilty of that. And it's fine. There's nothing on that list that's, you know, going to cause major problems to our dogs long term. But what we have to think of is what each like element of the training plan is trying to achieve. And are we just masking problems? Are we hiding from problems? Or are we building a program that's robust and stable and gradually getting more difficult over time, but always at a level that our dogs can cope with? Follow me on socials. Instagram's my favorite. It's pooches.galore. And come and get involved in the discussion. If you've got any questions or queries or comments, this is the place to come and say hi. You know, drop me messages, write in my comments. The more discussion we can have around separation anxiety, the less kind of taboo it becomes and the more treatable it becomes for everyone along the way.